Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Louisville Orchestra Pre-Concert Conversations. I'm Carol Larson, one of the voices on Classical 90.5 WUOL. Glad to be here. And can you help me please welcome Maestro George Mester and Hannah Parks.
Thank you.
And they are the experts on this music this evening. I was just going to start out and ask, because I know, Hannah, you've got 15 minutes and you need to go. Mm-hmm. I want to find out what your conversations were together when you started talking about prior to the first rehearsal of this music for the Mahler 4.
The first music?
Yeah, I mean, the conversations. What were some of the things you were discussing, and what are some of the vocal challenges of this piece?
Well, don't forget, we met at the lobby of the Galt House.
Yeah, right.
In front of the birdcage.
Yeah, exactly.
Maestro asked me a question. What is the meaning of without parody? Because that without the parody is mentioned on the score by a composer, actually. Actually, yeah, that was the difficult thing for me to sing this piece. How can I sing like without this parody, like as a child, you know?
As a child of Das Knaben Wunderhorn.
Yeah.
The poem that she sings at the end of the fourth movement is from a collection of German poetry called Das Knaben Wunderhorn, which is the child's magic horn. And so how do you sing that?
I was thinking when we ask children a question, they answer just so simply. You know?
Innocently.
Yeah, innocently. And I think that is the key to sing this piece for me. That is innocent, naive, and natural way to see the world and see the people, like for children. I think that's the key for me.
That poem is Das himmlische Leben, the heaven's life, or life in heaven, as mm-hmm. it were. Mm-hmm. It's just a beautiful poem. And I hope you'll read it. It's probably in your program to read the text, because you'll be singing it auf Deutsch, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And probably the composer was very prescient, is that the word?
Prescient?
Right. It's a person who can think forward and know what is important in the future.
Oh.
I think. This is a growth experience.
It is, definitely.
So, because it would be so easy to try to sing this as the little kid, you know, walking down
the
road,
right.
You know, and acting kind of stupid. And so he says, do not sing this in a parodistic style. And so you knew that beautifully, and you did it great yesterday. There were no reviews, right? No, I don't think there's anybody left anymore.
There was nothing
just
to
us
say.
People.
That's right. It was so awesome, there was nothing to say.
Well.
And so you've sung this before.
Yeah, this is a second time to sing this piece for
third
me.
Time.
Third
tonight. Yeah.
Correct. Third.
Yeah. Where was the first time?
It was on. It was in Seoul, South Korea,
in Seoul? Okay.
Which is my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as time goes by, like I understand this piece more, like deeper level.
Right.
Yeah. I see the composer's intention through this piece. Yeah, so yeah, it's totally, beautiful music, and I'm so lucky to sing this piece again.
That's awesome. I was going to ask Maestro also for the Viennese evening that this is, and the program is glorious. Come on, Brahms and Mahler, please. It doesn't get any more glorious than that. But what made you choose those composers and perhaps those three pieces?
Well, a lot of it was just happenstance. The orchestra has not played the Tragic Overture nor the Variations for many,
right?
many years. So this is almost like giving them new pieces to
mm-hmm,
play,
mm-hmm.
which has been always my hope. Eventually, after the fact, after I had made the program up, I realized that there was a lot of connection, particularly between the Variations and the Mahler, because the third movement of the Mahler is a set of variations.
That's right.
And so this is just a totally different way of doing variations. And so I was brilliant ex post facto. I was prescient.
That's right. That's right. That's a good thing to be. That's a very good thing to be. This is one of the smaller Mahler, not smaller of the large grand scale of Mahler pieces. If you've heard Mahler 2, Mahler 3, Mahler 8, they're just fantastically huge orchestras. This is a little bit smaller, but what are some of the challenges that you were facing with the orchestra in Mahler per se? Have they played much Mahler at all?
Yeah, I think so. They've played, I believe, all the symphonies except the 10th. Mm-hmm. They've played all the difficult ones, the 3rd, the 7th particularly. Mm-hmm. And I think the challenge for any orchestra is to follow exactly what's printed, because the way that he orchestrates or scores the music is that he has instruments doubling a melodic thing, but while one instrument or one set of instruments is making a diminuendo, the other one is making a crescendo. And so you have this kaleidoscopic. ear vision of just scintillating colors. And so most orchestras are used to blending. And so part of the training that an orchestral musician has is to blend with the others. But here they're required not to blend. And so until you have convinced an orchestra that blending is the bad thing to do in Mahler, it takes a little while. Mm-hmm. But once they understand the little piece of glass or mosaic that they're... That they are in relation to the complete picture. Once they get that, then all of a sudden the colors are perfect.
Comes together.
So that's the challenge.
That comes together. I was going to ask Hannah another question. Is in your the first time you were learning this, the very first time you were learning this piece, to as a singer myself, you know, read the poetry, understand the poetry so much, and of course singing it in German. What do you do as a doctoral candidate, for example, as you are? How did you approach it, and how did you learn it?
Actually,
what was important
to
you?
The first thing for me is understanding the poetry. That's the first one, mm-hmm. Do. Because the text is everything, like, not everything, but it's everything. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's the key for me. And listening to the music, and then with the, like, full score, even not just vocal score.
Yeah, I need the full score.
I need to know which instruments with me together,
yeah,
or which instrument has a crescendo or decrescendo that I need to do.
That's very important. That. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah,
actually,
that's the processing.
Right. Because what she's saying is, normally as a singer, you'd learn it with a piano score. So you've got, you know, the two mm-hmm. claves, you have the piano. Mm-hmm. But when you've got what she said, learning it with the whole orchestral score, you can see which instruments could be doubling your mm-hmm. your part, or mm-hmm. who's in thirds with you, or whatever it is, and you can better see what's happening harmonically with you.
But Hannah is a terrific pianist, and so you see, she could probably accompany herself as she's learning the piece, and that's what makes her such a great musician.
That's awesome.
Because many singers can't read music, and
that's true.
Yes, especially the high-paid ones.
You know, the joke in music schools: there's musicians and then there's sopranos.
Oh,
okay, but and also, you notice this piece is it's not like singing in a bel canto opera where everything stops and the soprano goes and sings this glorious bel canto aria. It's so part of the orchestra, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, there's lots of variety in it. With fun and bright and even darker side. Actually, it has like it has a beautiful melody, like legato line, but all of a sudden choppy lines interrupts the legato line. So that's the most fun part for me to sing this piece. Yeah.
Also, there's a lot of tone painting. For example, when the question of oxen mm-hmm. is part of the poetry, all of a sudden you have instruments bellowing out like oxen. So you have the basses and the horns and the bass clarinet going.
Sounds like an ox or a cow.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's great. You know, and so that was, for example, very difficult to get because it's written with this kind of crescendo diminuendo on one note.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So that's almost impossible to do, but if I tell the orchestra, put an accent on the middle of the note, then it's and then it's automatic. Mm-hmm. So those are the little tricks that one learns.
In conducting,
right.
Conducting 101. Yeah. Were you an ox at one time in your life? That was a good
Was
name.
I an ox?
That was a good song.
I was an ass.
Very good.
For going into music at all.
We all think that sometimes. But anyway, that's great. I mean, so I know you'll enjoy the Mahler. Let's talk a little bit about the Brahms.
No, let's talk some more.
Oh, because of Anna, because she's got like 3 more minutes to go.
So how come you have a German name?
Actually, Hana is a Korean traditional name.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's Hana. Yeah, Hana. Yeah, and also it means like number one. One, two, three, four. And yeah.
So you're number one in my book.
Well, there you go. Me too. My book too. And it's Hana because usually we see it Hannah.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, well, when do you think you'll be done with your doctoral degree?
I'm almost done with it, but I still have exams and dissertation. But I'm trying to.
And what is the theme that you have to waste your life on to get the doctorate?
Theme? Actually, I'm so interested in. Gyorgy Kurtak.
Oh, Kurtak, the Hungarian.
Yeah, the Hungarian.
You have to learn how to pronounce his first name. Gyorgy.
I was wrong. Sorry, maestro.
So you're not going to get your doctorate that way.
What are his dates of that composer? Is that who you said you were interested in?
Yeah, actually, the first time I sang his piece, it was at Tanglewood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I was like so.
Is he still living? I don't know the composer.
He's in Europe right now.
He's still living.
Yeah,
okay.
But still, yeah.
Very
but,
interesting. Yeah, so you're going to do a dissertation on some part of him?
Not so sure, but I'd love to do
something
for
like him.
Yeah, something like
that. What about recitals?
I did 2 recitals.
Already? So you've done your recitals?
I have one lecture recital left. So.
What is a lecture recital?
It includes like 30 minutes of lecture and then 30 minutes of singing.
Okay.
Doesn't kind that of combination. Tire your voice?
I think it'll be fine. Yeah.
You talk on the breath, right? Talk on the breath.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
That's really exciting. Do you have a specialty? I mean, do you prefer German lead? Do you prefer French chanson? Or do you?
I love German, actually. German lead. But I have to say I love everything in
it's
voice.
All great, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. Not even just classy, yeah, even like pops or
do
like,
some
yeah.
show tunes. All
yeah.
right. Get some show tunes on.
Yeah, I love music.
Do you categorize your voice as lyric
coloratura? Like lyric
coloratura.
Not lyric spinto, but
more of the coloratura.
Yeah,
what does spinto mean?
Spinto like it's from spingere, like it's from Italian, like
rather than this.
Spingere, yeah, like a
spingere.
Spingere, yeah.
It means to jump forward.
Spin, yeah.
It's to spin and jump forward.
Yeah, spin, jump forward, yeah.
And the spinto is usually a bigger mm-hmm. voice.
So you like to sing Mimi, for example?
Yeah, Mimi, but not a like heavy.
Not
like
a heavy Mimi. Do you do Violetta?
I'd love to. I did once.
Yes, I saw mm-hmm. that. And how about Gilda?
I haven't tried, but I'd love to sing that too.
Yeah?
yeah, I'm working on it actually.
Are you?
The aria.
That would be great, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, that's wonderful. Opera stuff. We're talking opera stuff, sorry, okay. Talking voice. Is it time? It's time for Hannah
time
to leave
to
us.
Go.
She's got to go be quiet
you're
now
in,
for a while.
You're in for a great treat here,
yes,
Hannah.
Yes, Hannah, thank you very much. Hannah Park, our soprano for the evening.
Thanks so much for coming.
Okay, now we can talk Brahms.
Yeah, well, let's just even talk if it's okay with you.
I'm fine. You go.
This song was written in 1892
right.
to be accompanied by piano. And so Mahler was not sure whether he wanted to include it with the Third Symphony or the Fourth Symphony. And so he finally, for some reason, decided to put it into the Fourth Symphony. And so how do you get into a song that's already been composed 8 years before? So what he had to do is, while he was writing the third movement, he had to find a way to introduce subliminally the theme in the last movement. And so there's this gigantic eruption of sound just before the end, And then as the timpani is wailing away, you have the horns going ba 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 bum. And that's the theme. Mm-hmm. And so that's this magic way of getting us not only to when the fourth movement starts, oh, that sounds familiar, but also the movement ends as though you were already in heaven. If you can play it in tune. Because what happens is that it's scored in such a way with lots of very high flutes, and the violins are playing almost close to their nose. And so it's almost impossible to gauge, especially way up like that in the violins. All it takes is a micro millimeter to move your hand, and you're out of tune. And so we worked quite a lot on that last chord to get it in tune. But by that time, you know that you're in heaven, and then comes the voice. So that's a beautiful, beautiful way of doing it. Now, we have another thing. Maxine, our associate concertmaster, sits usually inside next to Michael, who's the concertmaster. And the second movement is a fiddler's dance of death. And what happens is that the violin has to be tuned up a whole step. Yeah. So you have to come on stage with two violins. And you have to have one violin that's regular tuned and one that is one step up all four strings. I wouldn't want to do that to my violin because the pressure is unbelievable. But she borrowed a cheap violin from somebody. And it's supposed to sound like a cheap violin.
That's right.
It says the instruction in the scores is like a fiddle. And so now here's the thing. If you have perfect pitch and you see a note, the note is written as though you're playing the regular violin, right, but it sounds a tone higher. So if you, for example, see a D written and you put your finger down on the D, it sounds E because it's a step higher. So somebody with perfect pitch goes crazy with that because the person is playing notes that don't sound the way they look. And so Michael had some kind of family business to attend to, so he was unable to play this performance. But she learned about it only 2 hours before she was supposed to play it.
Oh, wow.
So she did an incredible job, and she, you know, we have a great amount of talent in this orchestra.
Absolutely.
So she's playing under these circumstances. Michael came in for the final rehearsal, so he's sitting next to her.
Is that right?
It looks really weird.
That is a very interesting story. And I knew about the violin being tuned up a step, but I thought that was really, really strange. It does make for a strange sound.
Well, it's supposed to not sound lyrical. It's supposed to sound
demonic
or, you know, ugly.
Yeah.
So she's doing ugly very well.
Just like Mahler asked.
That's right.
Exactly. You do what the composer asks. Exactly. So you told me that they haven't played the tragic overture of the Brahms in how long?
I don't know how long, but it's been a very long time.
Really?
They all came to me and said, oh, my God, we haven't played this in a long time. And what happened, you see, one of the challenges in putting this program together for this concert is that on Wednesday morning, which is our first rehearsal, we had a tornado warning. So in the middle of the rehearsal, we had to go down to the depths of this building in order to be safe. So we lost a whole half hour of work. And when you realize that while the first rehearsal is 2.5 hours, there's a 20-minute break. So it's already 2 hours and 10 minutes. And then the afternoon rehearsal is only 2 hours with a 15-minute break. So then you lose an extra half hour. That's rough. And with the orchestra not having done the Brahms Haydn variations, I thought to myself, we better just cancel it. So, because there's not enough time. It's like Obama said, I'd rather be a great one-term president than a lousy two-term president. So I'd rather present a really terrific program than a lousy full program.
Yeah, right.
However, the orchestra said, no, let's do it. Let's do it. We can do it. We can. Oh, yes, we can.
Yeah.
So we did it. And so it's going to be great.
Yeah, it's wonderful music. It's really wonderful music. What else have you been up to? Keeping out of trouble.
Just packing, you know, and doing things like that, preparing concerts, studying music, going to the movies.
Yeah. Let me ask a conducting question then. For a score that maybe you haven't looked at in a long time or a new score, what's your approach to learning that?
I'm not sure I understood the question.
If you were going to debut a new piece, I would just be curious about that, and you get the score from the composer, as the wonderful conductor that you are, how do you approach a new piece? Do you get a piano score and play through
it? No, you don't have piano scores, for example, for the Elliot Carter Variations
exactly,
for Orchestra.
Exactly, that's exactly
Were you
right.
all there? Yes. Whoever said yes was probably there. Okay. So this is a piece that I've actually had to study for half a year before.
Is that right?
Because it's extremely complicated. And I had to find a way to convince the orchestra that it was a wonderful piece. And so that involved having the rehearsals go on in such a way that all of this thicket of sound was clarified for them so that they understood why it is that they had to play what they had to play and how to play it. So that was so that takes a long time just to study it, to realize how you're going to actually rehearse it the very first time. And of course, when we did the first edition records, there was tons of music that I'd never heard before. And you study just like you study any other piece.
Right.
It's
your instrument.
You look at it. You know, it's like conducting students ask me, how do you prepare a new piece? And I said, I don't know, because I've been doing it for so long. It's like reading a newspaper. You know, you can't explain how you do it. You open the newspaper and you read it. And that's what you do with these scores. What's fun is having the composer there. Mm-hmm. Very often it's fun. Sometimes it's not. Because very often, most composers are extremely loose about how they like their music. But there are some that are absolutely hysterical if there's anything that happens that they didn't think of before. And so, in general, I've really enjoyed having composers, in a way, only because it relieves me of any responsibility. I don't have to make any decisions. The composer's there.
Yeah, right.
You want it louder? Sure, louder's fine. So that's in a way, way not to feel overwhelmed by the ethical necessity to figure out what the composer actually meant when he or she wrote these notes. That we could ask Mozart the same question.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Exactly.
And what's interesting also is that when you hear performances by Bartok or by Stravinsky that have been recorded, they deviate so much from what they printed that you can't believe it. And so you have this quandary specifically with composers who have been gathered is how much do you follow what's printed and how much are you free to interpret? So that's the fun of being a performer.
That's the fun part. Yeah, absolutely. That's a very interesting thing that you, because usually this is what's printed, and I have some leeway, but then when you hear the actual composer conduct it, and it's so much more rubato or whatever
and,
it is.
No, but very often it's exactly the opposite. For example, Richard Strauss was absolutely straight. He didn't linger over anything. It was not at all this kind of sexy kind of juicy music. It was just boom, boom. And there is actually a cartoon of him conducting, and he's taking out his pocket watch to see what time he can start when he can start his card game. So he was not a sentimentalist. But now that's how you do Strauss.
That's
sentimentally.
That's true.
You happen to play it straight, you're not considered to have understood what the composer wanted.
Good grief.
Good grief indeed.
So I have to ask the question. Don't slap me. So who, I mean, I know being a conductor and being in the, all the music is wonderful. I know that. But I do. I have my composers whom I adore. I mean, I love them all. But whom do you really love?
Well, I really love Mozart. For me, that's it.
Is that right?
Yeah, and if I could do all his piano concertos, that would be fine.
But there's so many notes.
No, that's what the emperor said.
I know.
Right.
And Mozart didn't know which ones to get
rid
of.
You know what's interesting? For me, Mozart and Strauss are very much in common. First of all, they were great illuminators of the human soul. When you think of all the operas and how he was able to delineate each character's personality and fears and loves through the music, and Strauss is exactly the same. And also Strauss has a lot of notes.
This is Richard.
Yeah, Richard Strauss. And so that's why I love both of those composers, because they are so human.
That's very interesting. I hadn't heard a comparison between Mozart and Strauss. That's very interesting.
For me, they're almost the same.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Mozart was so incredible. He was, well, audience questions. Anyone for the maestro before?
Well, that's a good question. The question is, how did he know how to end the piece, right? Where to put the song?
Where to put the song?
And, well, you know, composers have, I mean, in those days, certain tonalities. And the way that they use tonalities is a journey by itself. For example, Mozart, Don Giovanni, has a whole architecture of tonalities in which certain tonalities are associated with certain emotions and things. And in the old days, during the Romantic era, they used to stop Don Giovanni when he goes to hell, because it was so dramatic. But it ends in the wrong key, you know? And so how can you end in the wrong key when the whole piece is written with the architecture of the key relationships all between all of the pieces? So I imagine that you could not do the song and then do some loud ending, because the song says it all. It wraps up everything, and it ends the way it should.
And when you hear it, you'll hear the perfection in that piece, and it's exactly where it should be, isn't it? It's just exactly. Yeah. Other questions from the audience before Maestro has to go back and rest before the concert?
Dress? Did you
rest,
say?
Rest.
Oh, rest. No questions? I can't believe there's no questions.
There's usually questions. There's usually lots of questions.
Yes.
Yes.
Do any pieces strike fear in you to conduct?
Well, you know, for example, I worry about this piece a lot where I did, because this piece particularly, I've done it in so many different ways. And what strikes fear in me is, why did I do it that way in the past? You know, and how am I going to actually find the right way to do it this time? And so the journey of starting, because I haven't done this piece now in about 3 years, the Mahler. And so I have my recordings from my previous performances, and I listen and I say, man, that was so boring. You know, how could I possibly have missed the whole point? You know, and so that's what strikes fear is, am I going to actually repeat the stupid mistakes, or can I find new mistakes?
Well, thanks for your honesty.
What contemporary composer today, would people be enjoying 200 years from now?
I'll be in touch.
I think it's time for my show to...
You know, in the old days, people thought that Joseph Suk was a great composer.
Yeah.
You know? So,
interesting.
That can't answer your question. If I could answer your question, I could retire right now.
That's right. But that is a very good question. In 200 years, in 200 years.
100 even.
Or even 100 years, you know, which composer would you
So, no about? More questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Maestro.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Looking forward to it.